The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Lots to get to on today's program. Coming up later on in the show, we typically collect articles as they come in about just some of the drawbacks to excessive screen time, and we're also coming into the summer where all of us, no doubt, are hoping to get outdoors more often and get more exercise, get more movement, as I discussed, I think, in a show back in February. So we'll look at some of the more recent articles along these lines and also provide you with some encouragement, you and your family, your children too, to get outside and to move, especially this summer as the weather turns nice. So we'll come to that in the second segment. Later on in this segment, we'll get into the signature prophecy of Herbert Armstrong. We haven't talked about the formation of a United States of Europe, a really fascinating and revealing piece at the Berlin Policy Journal, I think it is. We'll get into that toward the end of this this first segment. And also, just again, as far as programming notes go, tomorrow the plan is to talk about the visit that I recently had, or the family vacation, I guess you could call it, or the trip that we took through Virginia on the way to the spring holidays in North Carolina. We stopped to see Jefferson's Monticello, and it was... Well, it was exciting and amazing to be there for the first time in my life, and also, in a lot of ways, very disappointing to just see how the staff, to see how the tour guides approached that history. Lots of fake history, you could say. Certainly history that's been heavily politicized. So we'll get into that in some great detail on tomorrow's program. We've been pulling together some research on that. I've wanted to talk about it, but I just wanted to do a little extra reading before getting into it. So if you're interested, be sure to tune in to tomorrow's program. Well, the Democratic presidential candidates, they're scrambling for TV coverage. There's, I think, more than 20 of them now. So they're making the rounds. They're trying to get attention. You had Beto O'Rourke yesterday. He's promising to spend $5 trillion to fight climate change. And so far as I know, he's not explaining anything about where that money will come from. But think of it, $5 trillion to fight climate change. This was how he announced it yesterday, clip one.
We are announcing the most ambitious climate plan in the history of the United States. We will ensure that we are at net zero greenhouse gas emissions by the year 2050, and that we are halfway there by 2030, a little more than 10 years from now. That means mobilizing $5 trillion.
As he said there at the beginning, the most ambitious plan in the history of the United States. So you have AOC, Ocasio-Cortez, and now you have Beto O'Rourke. He's taking it to another level. And last night on one of the cable shows, he sounded the alarm, just like AOC has done recently. We only have so much time left, so we have to drop everything and just pour the money, pour trillions of dollars into this effort. Here's what he said in a news interview, clip two.
I want to make sure that those who work in the oil and gas industry, those who work in the fossil fuel industry, are brought along as partners to make sure that we make this transition in the 10 years that we have left to us, as the science and scientists tell us, to make the kind of bold change that we need.
The 10 years that we have left. The scientists tell us this, he says. I forget again the title of Joel Hilliker's article. We went through it in detail last week. Where, as he said in that piece, on the one hand, you have them continually, repeatedly referring to science. And, of course, they manipulate the science. They play with the numbers, and then you come over to some of this transgender nonsense, and science is out the window. Forget about what science says. That's from the recent Trumpet magazine. So here are all the candidates that are out there trying to outdo each other. And they're lining up because they think it's going to be so easy to take down Donald Trump. They've got all of the press on their side. But when you just compare just the energy, the enthusiasm of those supporters that come out to see the president, like his rally on Saturday night, I forget where it was, but another boisterous, another enthusiastic, another exciting rally, and he's 2 years into his presidency. You compare it, like with Joe Biden yesterday, he hit the campaign trail last night. I think he was in Pennsylvania, and it was, if you saw some footage from it, you can see right away it's not quite as energized as the Donald Trump rallies. There certainly weren't as many people there. And, of course, Biden got quite a lot of coverage last Thursday and Friday after he made his announcement. We've touched on some of that recently as well. In fact, we'll play some from his announcement on tomorrow's program. But he's going forward. He hasn't yet gotten an endorsement from Barack Obama, which seems a little strange. And he and some others in that party, Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden, they're in their upper 70s now. I think Biden's 76 and Sanders is 77. And Donald Trump's only 72. And so he drew attention to that the other day, talking about just how young he is. This is what the president said, clip 3.
I just feel like a young man. I'm so young. I can't believe it. I'm the youngest person. I am a young, vibrant man. I look at Joe. I don't know about him.
And, of course, the comedians had a lot of fun with that last night. The young, vibrant man. This was another, in all seriousness, they told us this was another lie. He's not young. In case you didn't know, 72 is not young. So this is one of the thousands of lies that President Trump has made in just over 2 years. The Washington Post has a headline, President Trump has made more than 10,000 false or misleading claims. 10,000, they're keeping track. Everything that he says in a 90-minute rally, every word in a 45-minute interview with Sean Hannity, every single word with a 17-minute chat with Mark Levin, every word has to be carefully analyzed. 10,000. That's an average of 23 lies per day, the press tells us. The Washington Post says the milestone appeared unlikely when the fact checker first started this project during his first 100 days. In the first 100 days, Trump averaged less than 5 claims a day, which would have added up to about 7,000 claims in a 4-year presidential term. But the tsunami of untruths just keeps looming larger and larger. It's out of control. It's dozens of them a day. And then it goes through and gives you all the facts and the figures, the way the Washington Post sees it. The minutes he spent with Sean Hannity and the rallies and so on, the speech at the NRA. It says the president's constant Twitter barrage also adds to his totals. All told, the president racked up 171 false or misleading claims in just 3 days, April 25th to April 27th. That's more than he made in any single month in the first 5 months of his presidency. Think of the scrutiny that this president is coming under. And then the bias, of course, that factors into the fact that they would jump on a statement like, I'm young. I feel young and vibrant. And they pounce on him for that, of all things. And it's not just the misleading statements that they're so eager to point out. As I said on yesterday's show, they're out there just outright saying it's the president's fault. When there's a mass shooting, it's the president's fault. He's to be blamed Forget about the anti-Semitic cartoon that the New York Times runs for days before they finally come out and apologize. It's just out there. It's circulating. And then they say, well, it was one person that was behind it. And they won't even reveal the individual. And of course, it was more than one individual. Think of the many people that saw the cartoon. Benjamin Netanyahu, represented as a dog, leading a blind president of the United States, and that would be Donald Trump. And it's out there for several days. And then finally they come forward and apologize yesterday. But you reverse the roles. Someone, probably multiple people, would have had to have been destroyed for that. As it is, we don't even know who the individual was. That doesn't have any kind of influence or bearing on mass shootings. But what Donald Trump says, well, he impacts everything because he's Donald Trump and he's despised. There was a story about the Netflix show. I think we talked about this several months ago. This show about a suicide. It's a series that culminates in this teenage girl's suicide, and it's supposed to be just horribly graphic, how she kills herself and so on. And this program, it's wildly popular among teenagers. And it says here, suicides among U.S. children ages 10 to 17, 10 to 17, jumped to a 19-year high in the month following the release of a popular television series that depicted a girl ending her life. That was a TV show about a girl, a young girl, ending her life. And now we see this dramatic escalation in teenage suicide. It says here, the study published on Monday cannot prove the Netflix show 13 Reasons Why was the cause, but there were 195 more youth suicides than would have been expected in the 9 months following the show's March 2017 release. So we just don't know for sure if there's any connection here. We know Donald Trump is responsible for mass shootings. That we know. But we somehow cannot connect all of this Hollywood glamorization of teenage suicide. We're not sure if that connects to actual suicides. We're not sure about that. We're not sure if anti-Semitic cartoons, like what you'd see in the Nazi era, we're not sure if that really has any kind of impact on the behavior of these extremist groups. We certainly know, though, that Donald Trump is connected to everything bad that happens. That's pretty much the way the news media approaches story after story after story. An upside-down world. There's a headline at the Federalist. Authorities to arrest father if he refers to trans child as her real sex. So if he, this is in British Columbia in Canada, if the authorities determine that the father refers to his child, well, what is she? I guess it's a girl who now says she's a boy. If the father gets it wrong, he could be going to jail. Another headline from the upside down world, the Supreme Court ruling on whether men can wear women's clothes at work. That should be a big breakthrough for us. We were talking just the other day in our scrum meetings for these programs, how that headlines, titles, things you wouldn't imagine seeing 5, 6, 7 years ago. It's just every day in the news that we gather. It's there in the stack. We could get into this kind of thing every day, but how depressing would it be? The Apostle Paul talked about things that you don't even speak of. It's so demented. It's so crazy and bizarre. It's so evil through and through. Well, we have to talk about some of it because it's also, it also illustrates just how sick the society is from head to toe. At Al Monitor, there was an interesting piece about these prisoners released. Israel released a couple of prisoners to Syria. And it says that, I guess two of them, it says that Jerusalem described this as a goodwill gesture toward President Bashar al-Assad's regime in Damascus. It was the sole decision of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, made without authorization from the cabinet and carried out in utmost secrecy. So Prime Minister Netanyahu has come out and said, look, this doesn't mean there's any kind of secret deal that's going on. It's just a goodwill gesture aimed at Syria. But then this point made at Al Monitor, it says, could it be that the Israeli-Syrian deal was designed to mobilize Assad to leave the Iranian camp for the Israeli side with Russian encouragement? Could it be? Could it be Israel's attempt to drive a wedge between Syria and Iran? And of course, we know that that wedge is eventually going to show up. It's prophesied. You think about the Psalm 83 alliance, put it together with Daniel 11, and we know which nations are going to be on the side of Iran, radical Islam, and which nations will align with the King of the North, the German-led beast power. And speaking of the King of the North, this Berlin Policy Journal, this article points out how that Europe needs to be more like the United States was early on when you had all of these states, these 13 colonies, coming together, and they had to give up some of their freedoms and such and have a more centralized government, a united military, a common currency, those kinds of things. This is what we need to do. There's the model. This magazine, by the way, the Berlin Policy Journal, it's published by the German Council on Foreign Relations, which receives funding from Germany's Foreign Office and from other large European companies like Deutsche Bank and Airbus. So this is a magazine, Richard was saying this morning, this is a magazine that that does carry some clout among German leaders. They look to this. It's influential. The article that I'm drawing your attention to, it's titled States of Europe Unite! Exclamation point. States of Europe, let's come together. Let's unite. And it points out how Europe is facing a lot of crises today. It says here, in short, we're facing a situation that just a few years ago would have been relegated to the realm of fantasy, regarded as unthinkable, intolerable even. Today, it's being recognized with alarming nonchalance as the new normal. All of these crises, Europe too often paralyzed with these crises, these dangers. And so the authors of this this essay, they're saying, look, we need a radical new direction for Europe. We need to copy the United States in those early years. Go back to the U.S. shortly after the revolution, even before they drafted their constitution. And look at America. Look at that critical period, that history between 1776 and when was it? 1787, I think it was. Look at that critical period when you had an American nation that was somewhat paralyzed until they finally did get their government, their unity, that centralized leadership in place. This article is calling for European nations to essentially copy America in three different ways. The empowerment of the Union Parliament, the transfer of the supreme command of the army to a union, a united government, and then the consolidation of the debts of member states into a common national debt. So they're calling for the, well, some of the same things that some of these other commentators have been calling for years. The creation of a European army, a European government with its own taxes or taxation. It wants a super state. It wants a union. Now, we know what the Bible says about this union. It's a mixture of iron and clay, so it won't come together quite as easily as those early colonies in the United States. But still, even as we see the United States being ripped apart from forces within, here you have all these calls in Europe for the nations of Europe to come together. And how often did Herbert Armstrong prophesy of this? This was, as I said at the start of the show, this was his signature prophecy. Listen to what Mr. Armstrong said back in 1983, clip 4.
I want to tell you a little more about it, and that is the coming of the United States of Europe. Now, brethren, you've heard me mention that time and again. And I think that perhaps we don't realize what a pivotal thing that is in world history and what it means to us especially. Well, I can tell you now that the whole world is soon going to be rocked with astonishment and amazement.
It's a pivotal, pivotal moment. And the whole world's going to be shocked when they finally see this beast power. You think about the things we're preoccupied with now, the things we obsess over now. When this finally does happen, the whole world's going to be rocked with astonishment. Listen to what this article has to say. This is the Berlin Policy Journal. It says, history shows that successful nations, or unions, I should say, history shows that successful unions do not emerge from gradual processes in times of peace and tranquility, but rather as a consequence of sharp disruptions during periods marked by extreme crisis. Think about Herbert Armstrong again. And how often he talked about how it would take a crisis, an economic crisis in particular, to bring the nations together. And that's what this article's bringing out. It says successful unions happen as a result of events, of collective efforts by its citizens. It says Europe now needs such an event. A full debt and defense union underpinned by Parliament is the only way to resolve Europe's crisis and sustainably mitigate external threats. It says only then can Europe finally, finally become the positive force on the world stage that it should be. And so they're pushing this influential journal. It's pushing for Europe to rise to the fore, to be that influential superstate that it should be. In this same issue of the Berlin Policy Journal, there's another article, How Europe Got Lucky. The article is, it's like it's being written 20 years from now in 2040, and it looks back on how Europe united, how Europe came together. And the article spells it out that it happened after a series of crises. And it gets into some detail there, saying that first, Russia cuts off electricity to the Baltic states. That happens during a cold winter. Thousands die. NATO is paralyzed with inaction. It won't act. And then that triggers Europe, the European nations coming together, forming this super state. It's not really that far-fetched, is it? We've talked about that some. We might not know all the details, all the crises that will bring the nations of Europe together, but there will be crises for sure. My father, he wrote back in 2004 how that Russia frightens Europe and fulfills Bible prophecy. No matter what kinds of deals they may be working, behind closed doors or out in the open, you can be sure that the European nations, Germany in particular, that they're also very much concerned about the rise of Vladimir Putin's arsenal, his army. They remember history. They remember back to the early part of the 20th century. They know. Isn't it interesting, though, that the Berlin Policy Journal talks about a financial crisis helping Europe to come together? It says, with this new crisis, the new European thinking came full circle. That's from that second article in the Policy Journal. And here again, this is something that Mr. Armstrong was warning about back in 1983, 1984. He said it would be a massive economic crisis that would trigger the European unity, that would bring the nations of Europe together. That was in 1984. My father, more recently, in the Daniel Unlocks Revelation book, he said, Mr. Armstrong always believed the Holy Roman Empire would develop because of a crisis, mainly the failure of the dollar. Today, the dollar is in real trouble. He says the European Union has 25 members, or I guess maybe it's 26 today. This was from a few years ago. Prophecy says it will end up with just 10 kings or national entities. He says we can expect to see a considerable jolt, a catastrophic emergency that will radically reduce Europe from its inflated size today. Historically, an emergency is what has always bound church and state together in Europe. It's going to take an emergency. And that's what the Berlin Policy Journal's writing about. And they've even got an article in there that projects ahead to 2040 and then looks back and says, here were the emergencies that brought it all together. It says, then they have to depend on each other to be unified and strong. This is my father writing. After the crisis, it will still undoubtedly take a strong religious leader and a German political head to pare down the EU from 25 to 10 kings. It says, this time around, will that emergency be the collapse of the dollar? Probably so. Maybe it will be more than that. So we don't know every specific detail. But these are the kinds of things that these influential think tanks are now speculating about, are now discussing. They're saying Europe needs to become a United States of Europe. Forget this economic union. We need it to be similar to the United States of America. We can look at that American model and come together in a similar way. It's going to take some specific crises, but we can do it. We should do it. We should do it. We should rise up and lead and be a positive force on the world stage. Many are calling for that. And of course, the Bible, most significantly, the Bible prophesies of that as well. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program or submit any kind of feedback, you can write us at td@kpcg.fm. You can also submit some audio files or leave us a voicemail. You can just go to the TDRS page at thetrumpet.com and look for the big red button right in the middle of the page. You might have to scroll down a little bit, but you click on that and you can leave us an audio message, and we might just play your message live on the air. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The world is hopelessly confused about Bible history and prophecy. Understanding the Daniel 2 image could clear up most of that confusion. The Daniel 2 image gives an overview of history and prophecy like nothing else in the Bible. The Bible is a masterful work that should be studied in its entirety. The book of Daniel and the images described therein actually unlock the meaning of the prophecies in the book of Revelation. Our free booklet, Daniel Unlocks Revelation, explains the incredible prophecies contained in these two books. Studied alongside your Bible, this booklet, Daniel Unlocks Revelation, will bring the history and prophecy of your Bible to life. Request your free copy today. There is absolutely no cost or obligation. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
It's been a little slower going since getting back from our holiday travels, but before the break, I think there were three, maybe four Sundays in a row there where I went out for a fairly long walk. I think I started with 3 or 4 miles and then worked my way up to 5 miles. I've had a little hip trouble over the last several years, so something a little slower, particularly as I get older, I guess, and easier on the joints. I found that it was easier to squeeze that sort of activity in. But there were obviously more than just one or two benefits to getting out of doors, to appreciating God's beautiful creation, particularly here around Edstone. And then, of course, the exercise itself, the fresh air, the sunlight, all of that. But I even noticed after a few weeks, just I was timing myself each time that I did it, and I just tried to walk a little bit faster each time. And of course, you show improvement even after one or two walks. That program I gave back in, it was just the last 10 minutes of a show back in mid-February, I think it was, where we quoted John Adams, where he talked about move or die. I think he was writing to his son, saying that move or die is the language of our Maker in the constitution of our bodies. We've got to keep moving, or else it really does slow down in a hurry. Atrophy sets in and things begin to break down. Well, this summer, as this article at The Federalist brings out, this summer for you and for your family, for your children, make it a low screen summer. This summer, power off some of those screens and go outside. It says here, in the past decade, there's been an explosion in research and anecdotes demonstrating that screen use has some highly negative effects and that they're worse for children. And you know about some of these studies, and it goes through and gives the typical, what should be shocking figures of how much kids, young people, children, how much time they're spending in front of screens. Kids just 2 to 8 years of age, averaging something like 2.5 to 3 hours of daily screen time. That amounts to 20 hours per week for a 2-year-old, a 3-year-old. And then it goes up from there. 8 to 12, they're averaging 4.5 hours of screen time a day. And as you go up, you're, in some cases, you're looking at a full week of work time, 30 to 40 hours. Our teens might be in front of screens. It says here, teens could literally hold down a full-time job if they cut out the video games and YouTube. None of this is for school either, as school-age kids average 16 minutes a day. 16 minutes of daily school-related screen time. So most of it's not for school at all. It's just for entertainment. It's just a big waste of time. And worse, in many cases. The article talks about how that deep down, you know, we know this is bad. We know it's unhealthy. We know we need to cut back. We know we should have our children cut back. But then parents just continue to get them the next greatest, latest gadget. There's no restrictions. It says one of the worst things about screen watching, the equivalent of a part-time or full-time job's worth of hours in a week, is all the potential for creativity, learning, self-care, and happiness. It sucks out of a person's life. It's a major opportunity lost. A few of us have been going through this Isaacson book on Leonardo da Vinci. And you know, he was a little bit of a weird guy in many ways, but But the creativity, the powers of observation, the attention to detail, it's fascinating to read about someone that really did look at the tiniest of tiny details and would spend hours and hours trying to make sure it was just right on his painting. And of course, he was many things more than just a painter. But when he was in his teens and when he was in his 20s, he was trying to learn how to create masterpieces. What an opportunity lost. If we're spending a full-time job's worth of time every week looking at a screen. It says some other things in this article. Recent data from 28 advanced countries shows that kids are sick. Compared to kids 50 years ago, kids today take 90 seconds longer to run a mile, and their aerobic fitness has declined by 5%. It says parents are also reading to their kids less than ever. And then it gives some facts and figures on that. Both parents, children alike, we're more inactive, more sedentary than we've ever been, and it's shortening our lifespans. It's certainly taking away from the quality of our life. Another piece here from AP News. Americans getting more inactive, computers partly to blame. The sedentary lifestyle. We spend almost a third of our waking hours sitting down. And then it gives some recommendations on the amount of activity we need to be getting in each week. Walking, jogging, biking, tennis. Another one here from the New York Times. Is sitting a lethal activity? This is something that we got into back in February. And we've had some articles, some good ones, at thetrumpet.com by Joel Hilliker and Jörg Mardian. Even about getting up and standing during the workday. Putting in some movement where you can. I touched on some of this again back in February. But carrying on here to another piece, at The Verge, it says, the lure of computers means Americans are sitting more than ever before. And then this article says that standing is not enough. It's better to get outside even and take a short walk during lunch or during your break. Get in some movement. Take a few extra minutes. There's more than one benefit, as I said. Just getting outside. It says even if you're working in a big city, if you can go outside and just stand next to a tree for a few minutes. Well, it talks also about the benefits of walking. Another one here from the Telegraph. It says how walking can transform your body shape, even if you don't go to the gym. And again, I know we have a lot of listeners who are getting older like me, and the CrossFit style workout may not be as easy as it used to be. You can, of course, show improvement. Start out small and work your way up. But walking, this is something that Herbert Armstrong, I've got some quotes from him that we'll get to later, but he was a big proponent of the daily walk, particularly when he, in looking at his own life, made some changes back in 1967 when his wife died. He really evaluated himself and sounded the alarm for the entire church. Another one here says, a walk in the park, just 20 minutes with nature beats stress. Here's another benefit. It can reduce stress. A 20-minute lunchtime stroll through the park is one of the most effective stress-busting treatments that a doctor can prescribe. Further on, it says, our study shows that for the greatest payoff in terms of efficiently lowering levels of stress hormone cortisol, you should spend 20 to 30 minutes sitting or walking in a place that provides you with a sense of nature. You don't have to travel to the wildlands. Get out of the office and sit next to a tree. Well, as I say, when Mrs. Armstrong, Loma Armstrong, was ill in 1967, and just before she died, Mr. Armstrong really did open up to the entire church and talked about how we get sick and what we need to do to reverse some of those debilitating illnesses. And in his own life, he brings us out in an article. My wife hands this out in her nutrition class. But he had been letting down in exercise. And so he wrote to the entire church and said, I'm going to change this. And I'd encourage you to do the same. He talked about his daily routine in this 1967 letter and how that he had really turned to God spiritually. It says the fasting and prayer has resulted in almost completely removing all signs of the heart condition or the high blood pressure. So there were benefits both spiritually and physically to the extra fasting and the prayer. He says here, for 4 years, I have had to live knowing I could drop dead at any second. Now, listen to this, now pounds have been taken off. Now I can take longer, more vigorous walks. Now I'm taking them 3 times a day, regardless of circumstances, which might try to prevent. He says, now, no matter how many conferences are scheduled, no matter how pressing some urgent executive responsibility, I'm going 3 times or more a day to my prayer room God has blessed me with, there to commune with Him and to keep closer to Him. He says, my life from now will be far more active. And that new routine is already in effect and becoming well established. He says further on, brethren, there has to be an about face. I'm not ashamed to lead off in this. I'm not ashamed to set you the example. I am happy and rejoicing in God's chastening He has given me and doing my utmost to respond to it. He asks at the end, will you do the same? Will you make those same changes? We've just gone through the spring holy day season, the days of unleavened bread. They remind us that we have to walk out. We have to move forward and go out of Egypt. We have to remove the sin from our lives. Those weights, as I said yesterday, we have to set them aside and go forward and run in this race. Go back and listen to the last 10 minutes or so of yesterday's program. Now, like my father said in the Habakkuk booklet, now is the time to run. Not walk, but run. Well, Mr. Armstrong, going back to the 60s, going back to the 70s and the 80s, of course, he lived a long life. He lived until he was 93 years of age. And he wrote about healthful vitality. This is from a youth magazine right around the time of his death in 1986. He says, consider now what your life ought to be. It should be healthy. Based on a right diet, sufficient sleep, and normal but not excessive exercise, you should be vigorously, dynamically alive, physically and mentally awake to the real purpose of human life. God really, throughout his life, and of course he had his moments, going back to the 60s, where he let down, we all have those moments, but God really did give him a unique education. He was a servant of God who knew a lot about how to live physically and spiritually. We focus more on the spiritual for obvious reasons. That's more important, but the physical matters too. There's only so much you can do in service to God if you're down and out, if you're injured, if you're sick. But if you're filled with energy and healthful vitality, someone like that can really serve God in an active kind of way. And he stressed there in that quote that I just gave to you, it doesn't, in the case of exercise, it doesn't have to be excessive. But some of that, together with sufficient sleep, and of course the right diet, and that's hard to maintain in Ephraim and Manasseh, in the United States and Britain, because there's so many tempting offerings out there, or treats, or just plain bad food, fast food, that kind of thing. In another article, this is again back in the early days, 1928, he said, even in this case, it is likely that only certain parts of the body are receiving sufficient exercise. Walking in the fresh air every day is good, he says. For those who lead an indoor life, such sports as golf or tennis are splendid. Often bedroom exercises are advisable. Your body and muscles will not likely wear out, but can more easily rust out. Each individual must determine for himself what additional exercise, if any, he needs, as differing daily occupations naturally affect this. If you're more inactive on the job, then you may need to be more active after work. In 1965, this is from a coworker letter, Mr. Armstrong is writing from England, the Bricketwood campus, and he says here, we recently finished a new dining hall in a men's dormitory building, but we need desperately the new gymnasium that is planned. He really, the gym was important to him for the campus in England, and same with the Pasadena campus and the Big Sandy campus. It says the climate is such there that most physical exercise, which students must have for physical fitness and good health, must be taken indoors. By that, I guess he means that there's more rain and such in England. In any event, he says, a well-planned program of physical fitness exercises is in progress at each college, and this is just as necessary as any other part of college work. That's quite a statement. That's from 1965. He's emphasizing the importance of the physical education program. Physical education, PE. In another article back in 1954, he said the human body functions according to definite laws. It needs a proper amount of joyous, exhilarating exercise and walking. Not riding everywhere in a car, nor taking one's exercise sitting down in the paid admission stands of a baseball park or at a football or basketball game. It needs sufficient sunshine. Not the dark, dank congestion of crowded, man-built cities. We need to get outside. Jessica, one of my assistants, she was pointing out how that we've talked a lot in the last couple of years about the prayer rock, the rock, that the stone that we now have in Edmond, and how that Mr. Armstrong came upon that prayer rock because he was out exercising, out behind the Fisher Farm. He had all of those campaigns going on, and he had to get outside and be rejuvenated. Well, it was in one of those exercise sessions that he found that prayer rock, and then it became almost a daily pilgrimage for him to get out, to get outside, to walk up that hill or run, and of course to cry out to God. Our bodies, we do need movement. John Adams was right. There's a verse, 1 Timothy 4 and verse 8. It says that bodily exercise profits for a little while. That's how it should read. There is a profit to that bodily exercise. It does revitalize us. It does give us more energy. It does make us healthier. It does improve our physical stature. Our bodies are temples for the Holy Spirit. That's 1 Corinthians 6, verses 19 and 20. God says to glorify our bodies. That includes taking care of ourselves. There is a profit, P-R-O-F-I-T. There is a profit to getting regular exercise in. Philippians 3 and verse 19 talks about brethren who were, well, it says that their God is their belly and whose glory is their shame, whose mind earthly things, or who mind earthly things. Mr. Armstrong says it is, when he was talking about the diet side of things, what we eat, He said back in 1967 that it's literally true that you are what you eat, and dust you are. And he talked, of course, about acid and alkaline and the nutrients that we get from foods, and recommended eating more whole foods, vegetables and such, that come from the ground. We came from the ground. It said in that article, since you are merely food converted into a human body and mind, is it not plain that whatever food you put into your mouth has a very good deal to do with what you are and with your health or lack of it? Look at all of the advanced scientific knowledge that we have available to us today. All of this knowledge, and yet we have more doctor bills and we have more sicknesses than we've ever had. And the quality of life, it just continues to deteriorate. It's because we're not looking to our Creator. We're not submitting to His divine laws. God is our great Creator ruler. He made us. He knows what our bodies need. And He gives us plenty of instruction in His inspired word, the Holy Bible, about what to eat, about what not to eat, about what not to eat too much of, etc., etc. 3 John, verse 2, it says, Beloved, I wish above all things that you may prosper and be in health, even as your soul prospers. That's the Apostle John saying, above all things, I wish you to have good health. Good health, that's the foundation. Certainly a good part of it, a foundation for successful, productive living. And all too often, it's something that we really don't appreciate enough, good health, vibrant health, until we begin to lose it. And then we start making some changes when, well, you could say it's a little bit too late. That said, and my wife's had quite a few people comment to her during her nutrition class this year, older people, people in their 70s and 80s that are making some changes based upon some of the instruction that she's been reviewing, and they notice a difference right away. Whether it's the exercise they get into or the changes they're making in their diets. Even a 70, 80-year-old body can really begin to see some dramatic improvement if we consistently stay with it. Well, I'll close it off there. I've got a forum downstairs here in just a few minutes. But hopefully we can continue collecting some articles that have to do with the disadvantages of screen time, desk jobs, and the admonitions that we all need to get outdoors, to go outside, to get in more movement. And I did touch on the diet there toward the end. Maybe we can expand on that further at a later time. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, don't forget to send us messages at td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.